Welcome to Season 4 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we're speaking to some of the most innovative minds in the world of sports nutrition. We will be discussing everything from research, practice, and performance to give you an inside look into the exciting world of combat sports performance. Today, my guest is yet again, Dr. Oliver Bali. For those of you that follow the podcast, you would be familiar with Dr. Bali, who came on in Season 1 to discuss his research in hydration, fluid balance, endurance, and heat acclimation. He is a researcher out of Edith Cowan University, and in my opinion, Australia's leading academic when it comes to combat sports research. I've invited Oliver back onto the podcast to discuss his new research into the validity of the tools we use to assess hydration, and I also want to discuss with him in more depth his research into heat acclimation, which is fast becoming one of the most useful tools for combat athletes who participate in rapid weight loss. This is a hugely informative episode filled with open and honest dialogue that everyone in the combat community should listen to. There's a lot to get through, so let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live. So back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. So Season 4, we are looking at both gut health and performance nutrition. This episode, we're coming back to performance nutrition, and we have one of our OGs of the Fight Science Podcast. It's our second return guest from Edith Cowan University, Dr. Oliver Bali. Oliver, thanks for coming on, mate.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it last time, so I'm happy to do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. And we were talking a little bit off air, and I think your episode is one of the ones that is most quoted from the entire series. I think everything we spoke about there, right from hydration methods to something that's become a personal favorite thing of mine, which is heat acclimation, which we'll talk about later, it's gained a lot of traction, at least in the world that I'm in, and it's probably the episode I get asked the most about.
That's really good. I'm happy to hear that it's had a reach, and that's one of the things that's I think more difficult when you're in kind of my position as a researcher, is actually once you make this research, is actually getting people to see it and do something about it. Because I could have published, say, the heat acclimation, this heat acclimation paper. It's in IJSPP, which is the International Journal of Sports Physiology and Performance. And if, you know, it could just pass without anybody ever seeing it, really, except for a bunch of people in the scientific field. And it's good. I'm happy to see that it's actually seems to have made that jump from scientific information to actual practice, which is, yeah, easier said than done. I think I owe that pretty much all to you, by the way.
Hey, well, I kind of thought about it for a while. Hey, I was like, oh, should I just keep this as my own little secret and see? But you know what? Like the benefits, and we'll talk about it later, the benefits I've seen with my athletes are just absolutely phenomenal. But before we get into the heat acclimation, something we spoke about last time, and this is a big reason why I wanted to get you back on so we can discuss it, is we spoke a lot about hydration testing, hydration assessment, the validity of that in the context of combat sports. And this is what I want to go through with you. And I almost want to kind of run it through a second time just so everyone at home can hear it again. So let's go through it. Let's start talking about it. I'll leave the stage to you. Let's go over.
So the main thing that a lot of people, when we're going into this talk about hydration, that we need to understand is that the balance of water is actually a really complicated topic. And one of the things which, if I could get anybody to bear it in, but if I could have everybody bear one thing in mind and I could get it away from this podcast, it would probably be the importance of the location of that body water. And we store water all over our body. And the thing is, when we think, and we don't know a lot about, so we have a kind of theoretical understanding, but in terms of a working practical understanding, we don't know nearly as much as we should about where we pull water from, where that water goes, where it comes back, the time course of that recovery. And the easiest way I've always explained this is, let's say I jumped in a sauna right now and I lost 600 grams. So I lose 600 grams, I come out. Then I've got this bottle, 600 milliliters of water, and I scull this bottle of 600 mils. If you look at the total amount of water in my body in that moment, it'd be the same, more or less. Because I lost about 600 mils of water, and then I ingested about 600 mils of water. But the thing is, I'm not rehydrated, even though that water's still in my body. It's sitting in my stomach. And I think everybody can understand that fluid in the stomach isn't serving the functions that fluid in your cells is. That extrapolates even further, because once it gets into the blood, that doesn't mean it's in the cells. And water is kept in pockets all over the body, and it's a very delicate balance. And in terms of minor dehydration, it seems to be relatively easy to pull that out and put it back in where it came from relatively quickly. But when we look at combat sports, which is really obviously where my interest in this area is, it's an extreme circumstance. These guys are undergoing a level of dehydration that we don't see commonly. And the thing is, what we see is as people get more dehydrated, they start to pull fluid from different compartments more. So if you're dehydrated a little bit, it's mostly going to come from your plasma, so your blood, and then the fluid that your cells are floating around in. But if you start to lose, say, over 4%, you start to pull much, much more of that from actually inside the cells themselves. And from what we can tell, the more you lose, the harder it is to regain that balance. And there's also a lot of mechanisms going into that, which I can get into kind of later as it organically comes up. But the main point is that it is a really, really complicated topic. And the problem is, in this case, when the truth resists simplicity, people very much want it to be simple, and we want to have a simple solution to this problem. And unfortunately, I don't believe that we do. And yeah, I've put so much time and effort and thought into looking at this topic. And the more I look into it, the more I realize it's very hard for people to make informed decisions in this area with the amount of information we have.
That's something that I've really taken away, especially since we spoke last time. It's just this question, right? Is what is hydration? Like, what is a hydrated state? And then you think about, well, what is a hydrated state when we put it in the context of a combat sport athlete that probably went through a rapid weight loss phase where they've, you know, passively dehydrated, sitting in a sauna or sitting in a bath, or even if they actively dehydrated on a bike or hitting pads or whatever, what is hydration for those guys?
Yeah. And to be honest as well, this is one area which is a problem. And one of the things which I've been working on, as I mentioned before, a paper reviewing the methods of hydration testing, and it's fairly late stages, so hopefully we'll be able to see it soon, is about what makes someone hydrated. And when we look at these markers that we've created, usually there's a little range that says between this and this is hydrated. But I've got a lot of questions about where those normative values actually come from. And in writing this paper, I've tried to hunt for a lot of them, and they seem to look like numbers that people have just randomly picked. And that's a big problem when we're defining that as hydrated. You know, if I was to say use a urine test, urine specific gravity being the most popular one, if I was to pull most like 30 people off the street and just test their urine, I would be shocked if a third of them at least wouldn't come up as dehydrated in that test. And they're not going to feel terrible. And the question then becomes, are they dehydrated and is that a problem? Or have we set the bar wrong? Or is there biological individuality to this, that some people will walk around with a USG of, I don't know, 1.015, and some people walk around with 1.022? Is that just normal for them? And there's a lot of things that, and as more and more research is starting to come into the area of looking at spot testing, which is just like a single test, it's more and more consistently showing it's unreliable. And I think part of the reason that it is unreliable is because these normative values are just plucked from nowhere, or from a really old study within a very specific population where they've tested a bunch of them and gone, oh yeah, this is about what everyone was.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I've had this conversation when we talk about, say, things like glycogen in athletic populations. It's very difficult because of the glycogen, how much glycogen is held in the different muscle fibers and how that changes between athletic populations. Yet we tend to use these values that have been specific for a certain population, try to apply it to another. Let's go through these markers though, Oliver. I think the most famous one that we'll all probably be aware of because of one championship's drastic use of it in their hydration protocol is the urine specific gravity. And as you said, to be technically dehydrated in that, it's 1.02, right?
Yeah, depending on what, sometimes they'll say 1.02 or over 1.02. I'm not sure which one they actually use. But yeah, it'll be either that or above.
Let's talk about that value, like the range of that. And through your research, what did you find? Like, where did they come up with this value or this range of, okay, if you're under this number, you're hydrated. If you're over this number, you're dehydrated.
So I haven't been able to find it. Now, maybe that's an outcome of something I've just missed. It doesn't seem likely, but it's entirely possible. But a lot of this now, and I think this is one of the reasons why a lot of research is starting to steer away from using spot testing. And it is starting to become more prominent within the scientific community, that idea that you really can't just take a person and get a bit of their urine and look at it through basically something that looks like a kaleidoscope. Obviously less colorful when you look through it, but you look through this little kaleidoscope thing and then you know whether they're dehydrated or not. And I guess to talk about USG more broadly is that we need to think about, again, what I said before, the location of fluid. And urine is in the bladder. Urine serves no function, I guess, except for cleaning out your urethra as you pee, but you know. I'm not going to get into the functions of urine, but I mean, like, in terms of a cellular perspective, once the water is in your bladder and it's urine, it's no longer serving a function within the body. And the thing is, we're measuring that fluid. And if that fluid's dehydrated, does it matter? Is that necessarily a big problem? And that's one of the big problems we have, is knowing what is the value of your urine being dehydrated. So even if we knew that this wasn't a normative value, what is the value of that? And that's a big problem that we have here, because when I'm talking about compartments, that what we're mainly interested in is your cellular hydration. That's probably the thing that has the most impact on your function and performance. To a comparable extent might be plasma, but really cellular is where the money's at. And we don't know how good of an actual representative this urine is of what's happening in the cells. And the thing is, one of the problems with using urine is it is no way of knowing actually counting all the fluid in your body. What it does is when the blood passes through, it basically checks how diluted the electrolytes are. So it looks at electrolyte concentration. And this is one of the things which I know a few people are doing when they've had hydration tests, is if you're dehydrated, so when I sweat, I lose a lot of fluid from my various areas and I also lose electrolytes. And then if I over dehydrate a little bit and then take a bit of pure water, what's going to happen is that puts water back into the blood, but it doesn't put the electrolytes back and it dilutes it a bit. And then your kidneys start over filtering and then you wind up with clear urine, even though you're definitely not rehydrated at that point. And that mechanism alone raises a very big problem about the functionality of that actual liquid that we're trying to assess. And whether people are doing it intentionally or not, the body responds very oddly to really large portions of dehydration. And these tests weren't designed for that function. And there definitely are situations where USG is a functional measure, but the same deal that a sledgehammer might be awful at brushing my teeth, but it's really good if I want to knock down a wall. The tools have specific purposes, and the USG was designed for a more gradual chronic dehydration that, you know, for example, one of the better things for that would be if someone's working in kind of a hot environment in it for a whole day and you see at the end of the day how dehydrated you, or if someone's been in a medical setting and they haven't been able to drink for ages because they're having surgery and you didn't have a drip going through, how dehydrated is that person? These are what it was designed for. It wasn't designed, and even then there are still questions about, again, how much does that urine mean? But at least when I'm talking about the balance within the body, when you do these things gradually and you're not rapidly losing all this weight, at least the body is mostly hitting this state of equilibrium that we might be able to go, okay, the body's in mostly equilibrium. The urine is saying this, that's going to probably give us some good indication of what's going on elsewhere. The problem is when you take that and go, okay, cool, that's going to apply to a guy who's just sat in a sauna wrapped in a bin bag for like 2 hours and is on the verge of death. They're very different situations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think let's just put a bit of context around it too, because what we're talking about here is like when you're sweating, you're moving that fluid between those compartments. You're moving it from the blood, which is, you know, very close to the skin, and you're moving it. And when we're sweating, we're getting rid of heat in our body. And the way our body does that is by putting fluid on the skin to evaporate and it cools off. So we're moving between these compartments of, say, in our blood, which goes to our skin and then moves out, and we can move it from the area with all the cells to the blood to the skin. Or where it gets very dangerous is what you're saying. If you go overboard and you do, say, plus more than 4% of your body weight dehydration, there's a good chance you're moving it from inside those cells into the space between the cells, into the fluid in the blood, then onto the skin. And that can be problematic. And as you said, we'll just talk about it in one championship when they're doing this urine specific gravity. Theoretically, someone could drink, say, pure water after going through the process of going through, say, a dehydration process. They could have that pure water sitting in their bladder, but then they could also sweat and go through that same process and pass a dehydration or a USG test while technically being dehydrated in the sense in those other areas of their body.
Yeah. And you know what's a really, the very first time I learned that lesson was when I did my very first study, which is the one published in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research. And I found when we first started doing things that the urine results were really wonky. So I had people come in, and if they didn't do, so this was during the pilot testing, and if they turned up and they didn't need to, so I would get them to urinate once, and then they would have, when I said to you, okay, when I said to them, you know, you're going to be getting in a sauna. So they turn up, they're probably drinking a lot of water, they urinate, and then usually there's like a 40-minute period until we can actually get them in the sauna at that point. And they've been drinking water the whole time, and I go, oh, do you want to go pee first? And probably 50% of people when they came for pilot testing would go, no, I'm fine. And then they get halfway through the weight cut, because it was this heat protocol was 3 hours. They get halfway through and go, bro, I need to pee. And be like, okay, cool. So they go to the bathroom, and then their urine, I would always have to, when they go into the urinal, that they would need to not lock the door, and I would need to stand relatively close, like just outside the stall, if they decided they were going to pass out. Because, you know, obviously we really have to consider all these safety protocols when we're doing these tests within the university. But I would always hear just like an absolute waterfall of urine midway through. And then then they'd already lost a lot of weight at that point. Usually most people lost the most weight in the first hour and a half. And then it started to slow down as the body started to hold on to fluid more. And then afterwards, those people would have really high USGs. But then some people who said, some people who in the middle didn't urinate, they just go the whole way through. At the end, I go, okay, can you pee? And I stand next to them and I hear the rain, the absolute waterfall, and they come out with a vial of mostly clear urine, even though they've lost so much weight, because it's been sitting in their bladder since before they started. And then those people, it would say, they're super hydrated. They're ready to go. Even though they'd lost the same percentage of their body weight than these other people who had urinated midway. Because then obviously for the second half, it's only able to refill with what the body's actually delivering and not what was there before. And that was one of the first times where I went to my supervisor, my research supervisor at the time, and went, I don't know what's happening. Something's wrong with this. These urine measures are, and then we ended up controlling it for the actual study, but it immediately raised a point to me where I was like, okay, clearly this is wonky. And it all depends on how you collect the data. And this is, and again, it just outlines the very clear importance of the location of that fluid. Where is it? And what does it actually mean? What were the conditions around collecting it?
Yeah. And let's elaborate on that a bit more, Oliver, because it's an important point. Because when they're going to the toilet and they were urinating and say you're collecting that urine, that is the sample that's going through the urine-specific gravity. But you can also assess dehydration or hydration by taking, say, blood samples, a sample of blood, and you're going to assess the fluid that's in the blood. Like we spoke about earlier, fluid will move from the cells in that around the cells and in that area there to the blood, where then it'll move to the skin where we sweat it out. You can assess those other ones. And you actually did that in your study, right? You assessed urine-specific gravity against these other fluid markers, and you found exactly what we're just talking about.
Yeah, so what we did, the so we had a few markers in that study, which were we obviously had body mass change. We had serum osmolality, which is basically where you get the blood. So we do a venous blood draw. You put it in a centrifuge, spin it around, and then take out some of the liquid that's sitting on top. So all the red stuff goes, all the hematocrit goes to the bottom. And then you assess the concentration of that serum. So it's basically looking at serum and plasma are almost interchangeable words. And sometimes in the research, they actually get used interchangeably when assessing the hydration of them, but they are slightly different. And then there's also hematocrit, which is you take a finger prick blood sample, you get it in a little capillary tube, you spin it down, and you see how much of your blood is that red blood cell component. And they were the two blood markers we used in that study. And we found that they were far more conservative than the urine markers. So, and they were far more predictable as well. They did what we expected more often than not, which was, because this was the thing with urine specific gravity. We had their pre-data, no one was dehydrated. Then we had the post-data. So 20 minutes after the weight cut, they were much more dehydrated. But then according to 3 hours after, it said that for some reason they weren't dehydrated in the weight cut group. And then 24 hours later, it said they were dehydrated, which obviously it's weird that I very much doubt, considering their body mass was considerably less still at 3 hours later, that they'd actually fully rehydrated, because they'd also eaten in that time too. And we didn't weigh the food. So they clearly weren't fully rehydrated, but something was going on with that urine. Whereas the serum was far more predictable at the start. And this is one thing that's interesting, is that the markers were really close at the start. So 288 for the dehydration group and 289 for the control, which is, you know, it's basically nothing. And then immediately after, the dehydration group was obviously much higher. And then 3 hours later, back to normal, didn't change from there on out. And some criticisms of using plasma osmolality or serum osmolality as a marker of hydration status is that the body protects blood really aggressively. Like very aggressively, it protects your blood composition. Because if your blood gets too thick, you've got a really good chance that it can clot and you're going to wind up with a stroke or a heart attack or something. So the concern there is, when they were dehydrated 20 minutes after, and we started seeing fluid getting put back into the system, it makes sense that that would stick around in the blood first. But the question is also, is it still pulling fluid from the cells to try and keep the blood hydrated and just leave the cells a little less hydrated? The fluid of the blood isn't the fluid of the cells. Now, obviously, it acted more reasonably than urine-specific gravity did. But again, because you're pulling all this out and then throwing a bunch of fluid back in, if I scull this 600 ml of water, that goes into my stomach, and the first place it ends up is my blood. So that doesn't mean it's back in my cells. And it's basically just me talking about the location of fluid a lot, but it's really the most important part here.
Yeah. And I guess if you're listening at home and you haven't heard either myself or Oliver talk about this, the reason why this is important is because I always use the example, and something that is always talked about in big weight cuts is we talk about losing your chin or the chin weakening. And you see this a lot. If people complete big weight cuts, go into a fight, they're prone to being knocked out. And this can be problematic because if we're talking about this fluid shift and they've done this really big weight cut, they've moved fluid from inside their cell. And I always use the example of take a rock inside of a glass and shake it around. It's going to bang a lot. But if you put a lot of water in there, it's not going to bang as much. And it's a very similar effect. You think if you've got your brain cells and you've put your body through this huge or this substantial weight cut where you've lost this fluid, that could theoretically be a consideration that's happening in those cells.
Yeah, there is some research that does suggest that dehydration significantly affects brain morphology. So that could be a possibility. And the other way I've looked at this is that we know that weight cutting can significantly reduce physical ability. And generally speaking, people who lose fights get hit more than people who win fights. And if you've done this weight cut, and let's say there's a potential that your brain is more susceptible to damage, but then also you don't have as much energy and you get hit more, that's you're getting hit with two prongs there. So not only are you more sensitive to getting hit, but also you're getting hit more because you've sacrificed all this energy to make weight.
Yeah, absolutely. And just go over, just to explain it one last time, Oliver, when you're assessing the serum osmolarity and the hematocrit, that is the fluid in the blood, right? And that is important. And you're saying that your body, it seems that your body wants to protect that because obviously our blood is pushing around nutrients to all our cells and everything else.
Yeah. So the body, this is one of the things which I found when writing the review paper on hydration, was that there were a lot of people have kind of described two different scenarios where these markers work better. And it seems that serum osmolality is not very sensitive to more mild dehydration, and mild is 3% and under, but even beyond that is still actually a bit of a debate. So it picks up, if you're very dehydrated, the blood will show. But then it seems there's pretty consistent research showing that if you're not very dehydrated, then the blood won't actually pick it up. Now, it does seem that then they argue that in that case, for mild dehydration, urine-specific gravity is going to be more sensitive because the body aggressively protects blood. But so it conserves everything in the blood, and thus the urine will end up being dehydrated. I don't know how much stock I put in that, but what I do know is pretty much none of that makes sense when you do weight cutting. As soon as you, all these models and all these ideas are built on a person who is losing a reasonable amount of fluid in a reasonable amount of time. And the blood is very, the blood does protect, the body does protect blood, the blood composition, because obviously it's getting the nutrients around the body. If it clots up, then you'll die, or depends how, if you get medical attention or not, but the body protects that quite aggressively. But we don't really know what's going on in the body when you go from 7% dehydrated to just smashing a ridiculous amount of fluid within a 3-hour period. And chances are, because the first place that goes is your blood, because it has to go from the digestive system to the blood, then that will actually be the first one to go back to normal, even when the rest of it hasn't. So when it goes from my intestines to my blood, then my blood markers will look normal again. And then that has to then get into my cells, which we don't know. I'm not aware of a single realistic measure of cellular hydration. Obviously, I found, I believe, one study that had done something as a proof of concept a long time ago where they took a muscle biopsy. So they ripped out a bit of muscle tissue and then they dehydrated it and checked the weight. So they used like, basically like one of those fruit dehydrators, essentially. And they checked its weight pre and post, and they used that as a measure of hydration within the muscle tissue, which actually would plausibly give us a better indication of what's going on in the cells. But obviously, we can't be like sticking very big needles in people and ripping out muscle tissue within the combat sports situation, because that I would assume you haven't had a muscle biopsy before.
No,
they don't feel good. The way I've described it is it feels pretty much analogous to a real nice leg kick.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, that's about where it's at. And you'll be hobbling around for a day or two afterwards. We can't do that to fighters. And honestly, we don't even know how reliable this is at assessing cellular hydration. So the point is the blood, it does protect aggressively, but when that's not, we're not looking at this in cases of rapid rehydration. And for that matter, in that case, I think reasonably, and unfortunately there's not, well, there's some research that's caught looked at it in a secondary fashion, which would be like one of them would be my project, where we saw 3 hours later the blood was going, all right, we're back to baseline, even though their weight was still a kilogram down, and they'd eaten there too, so there was clearly much less fluid in their body, but the blood was fine. But then these guys were drinking fluids very aggressively, so obviously that's all sitting in the blood, and we just don't know how long it takes to actually replenish everything in the cells. Because the thing as well is your body doesn't consciously or actively, it's not really actively sending water to all these cells. It's an osmotic, balance. So the concentration of electrolytes inside the cells mixing with the concentration in the blood, and that could by osmosis or just the movement of water, the way it will naturally move, is then flowing into the cells. But when you dehydrate so aggressively, then you're pulling out all those electrolytes from the cells, you're pulling it all out from the blood. That entire system, which millions of years has evolved to balance all these things, you're just throwing out of whack. And then with these hydration tests that were designed for more or less normal circumstances, certainly normal compared to weight cutting, we're then expecting the test to still work. And arguably they don't even work in the real settings, but especially in this setting, it's very conflicting.
Yeah. And absolutely. I think we just come back to this point, right? Is, well, what is hydration then? And what is the state of hydrated and what's dehydrated? And I guess that's why I wanted to get you back on, Oliver, because it's confusing, and you often hear about this, and it's this theoretical consideration for what I see in practice all the time. And we can take athletes through this, and you know, I can get them on weight and they can stand on the scale, and it's like people pat me on the back and say, job well done. In reality, I don't know. I can rehydrate them. I can put the electrolytes back in. I can put the fluid. If we did have to go above that 4%, I don't know. There's no way for me to know if they were rehydrated. Are they hydrated? I don't know. I don't have any way of proving that.
Yeah, well, exactly. We have, if you said to me, Oliver, we're going to do, if you got Oliver, look, fight dietitians getting into the science stuff now. We're running a bunch of studies. Here we go. We want to do a lab trial to see how effective this rehydration protocol works. Okay, how do we test it? I go, I don't know. We could do some stuff. I don't know if it's good. Like, because I would pull out all these blood tests. I would pull out the urine test. I pull out the body mass. But the thing is, when we had these people 24 hours later, once they cut their weight, their body mass had pretty much returned to normal. Their blood had returned to normal. Their urine osmolality marker, which is a similar urine measure to USG, some people view it as more reliable, some people less. It's probably a bit less, in my opinion. That was saying they were normal. The only one that's saying they weren't normal was USG, and the difference honestly wasn't massive, but they performed worse. And the thing is, if you go to me, Oliver, were they hydrated then? I would have to go, well, they performed way worse. So no, but I don't know. Maybe it's not the dehydration that's making them perform worse, and it's some process that's happening throughout that dehydration. And that all comes into the really just, and the main thing I kind of want to get across is really just a demonstration of how little we know and how unsure we are on these topics. I don't know if you could give me access to my lab and you could go, could you tell me if I'm hydrated or not? And I could go, mate, I've got hundreds of thousands of dollars in this lab for testing hydration. You have the nerve to ask me that question. And they go, yeah. And I go, well, no, I don't know, actually. I've got all this equipment, but I don't know if it's actually going to tell me whether you're hydrated or not. I can make an educated guess, but...
Hey, guys, just a quick interruption to the podcast to give a plug to one of my favorite foods going around. Empire Jerky is an Australian-owned company that makes some seriously tasty jerky, all from fresh, local Australian ingredients. I know a lot of people say that, but these guys have taken that to the next level. They've even gone out of their way to source Kakadu plum to use in their recipes. I know what you're thinking. What's Kakadu plum? Well, it's a fruit that is grown by Indigenous communities across Western Australia, the Northern Territory, and North Queensland, and it has the highest natural source of vitamin C, a powerful antioxidant, of any fruit. Empire Jerky has become a staple for my athletes for a low-carb protein-packed snack during their fight camp to make sure they're in the best shape possible. If you want to try this for yourself, then head over to their website and throw in the code TFD10 at checkout for a nice little 10% discount. All right, back to the show.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I think that's really the point that I want to get across on this is that, and I think you find the more you dig into the science of this whole area, we always come back to this, and this is the importance of getting more research in this area and people like yourself specifically looking at the combat sports in a context basis. What does it mean in the basis or the context of a combat sport athlete who has just done this rapid weight loss or this rapid dehydration and the amount that they've done? What's it mean in that situation? Because that's completely different for if you and I are, I don't know, going for a walk around the campus or doing whatever, or we're sitting out playing basketball or whatever, it's completely different and we don't know.
Yeah. And I do feel the need to point out one thing, I guess, which is I've got, when I approach these things, a relatively conservative view that I try not to make any assumption that I can without really robust data to back it up. And I know I've had disagreements with other scientists within the field about these kind of areas. And obviously I respect them very much as what they're doing. And they very well might be right and I might be wrong. There's no way to know. But in some cases, we might be able to look at these things and try and extrapolate the data. And the problem is I just get very, very nervous when we're trying to extrapolate data into a situation which is clearly different. And there is a body of research looking at hydration. Honestly, that body is not nearly as complete as it should be, but it's especially not that complete when we're looking at the very specific situation of combat sports. And combat sports, or I should probably say weight-restricted sports, because you could reasonably get similar things with jockeys. But in any, realistically, in weight-restricted sports, and combat sports are really the worst for it, and the vast majority of people doing it. But in these weight-restricted sports, it is such a difficult situation that I just find it that I'm not able to, I can't see the justification for such extrapolations. And there very well might be scientists within the field who go, oh, Oliver's probably a bit too conservative there. I reckon this would still probably work. And maybe they're justified in that. But I think it's something that, and unfortunately, me saying that probably creates more confusion than clarity for most people. But I'm right. No, I'm joking. But it's just, it is, I think it just, everyone needs to understand. The main thing that people need to understand is that this is an extremely difficult situation. And if someone gives you an extremely clear answer, they're almost definitely wrong. If someone gives you a complete straight answer, goes, yeah, it's just this, and they're on this topic, then I would put basically zero stock in what they're saying, because it's just, regardless whether someone is willing to make a little bit more extrapolation with the data than I am, there's no way they could make that with a massive degree of certainty.
Yeah, absolutely. Or a massive degree of confidence, and that's it. Like, we just, we don't know. We can extrapolate as much as we want and we can do what's best practice by the evidence we do have. But the reality of the situation is that even though we have that body of evidence, we don't know how contextually significant it is. So Oliver, I think that's good. That's excellent. That's exactly what I wanted to cover and go over here. We're going to save the best for last. I'm going to not let you go yet because I want to talk to you about something that's fast becoming, like I said earlier, one of my secret weapons and one of my most favorite practices, which is heat acclimation. And I think it's a funny thing. Like we're sitting here in Australia, even in the winter, and it's like 25 degrees and you're thinking, why do you guys have to get heat acclimated? But if we're putting that in the context of combat sports and combat sport athletes, and we're talking about this rapid weight loss and what these guys go through, personally, as a practitioner, I find it hugely relevant. But I want to talk to you more. I know we discussed your paper, and which is probably the only, well, it is the only paper in the area that looks at this for combat sport athletes. I just want to talk to you and extrapolate on the points that you've made throughout that paper. So just for the guys listening at home, can you just quickly run us through a quick rundown of what you did with that paper and what you found?
So with this paper, what we did is, and it's funny because I said this before we went on air, it's interesting that the paper that I've published that probably has had the most impact on the field was one that I actually hadn't initially planned to do. And me and my research supervisor were planning out my PhD and we went, oh, we need another study in this spot or else it's not going to be big enough. And he goes, oh, I've got some guys doing heat acclimation. We could do that. And I'm going, oh, yeah, I guess. Okay. And I was never really very passionate about the idea. And then I collected the data and saw the results. And that was when I suddenly realized, oh boy, we've got something here. We've basically indifferently created a study because we just needed to fill the space. And just with an idea that was pretty good, but I thought, it's just probably not going to work. And then as soon as we collected it, I was like, oh my God, this is massive. And what we did was we know that because we had a period and we're still doing a bit of it at uni, but the cohort that was mainly doing that has moved on to kind of other areas. But we were looking really intensely for a couple of years at heat acclimation. And basically, the human body is really good at adapting to heat. It's pretty trash at adapting to cold, but it's really good at adapting to heat. And what we do in that case, and heat acclimation induces a lot of beneficial adaptations for exercise. And typically, we were looking at heat acclimation for exercising in thermal conditions. So for example, one of the big things within Australia, where we started looking at heat acclimation and heat-based research was when, I can't remember the Beijing Olympics was 2004? Oh, it doesn't matter. But yeah, the Beijing Olympics, when we were going, okay, we're going to compete in this area that's hot, where some of the races were taking place were going to be pretty hot at the time. And that was one thing where the AIS really made a push to trying to understand this better, and they did a lot of stuff pre-cooling and everything. And what we wanted to do was get better at exercising in the heat. Now, we looked at that research and looked at some of the effects that this heat acclimation had and went, I wonder if we could apply this to weight cutting. So what we did was we got some athletes to come in and they did two baseline sessions a week apart so we could get a double baseline. And where we assessed like markers of hydration, and we got them to do weight cuts of about 5% of their body mass. And then they rehydrated and performed, and we saw this difference. We did it, might have been 2 weeks apart. I'm not remembering my own paper nearly as well as I should, but these double baseline sessions happened. And then we did the heat acclimation protocol. And that heat acclimation protocol was an hour and a half in a sauna with 12 occasions, with no more than 3 days between each exposure, because there was research that found that you didn't necessarily have to do the exposures back to back. They found if you did it 3 days apart, you actually generated the same strength of adaptations. It just took three times the greater amount of total time to actually do it. But so if you did it in 1 week, it would take three, but you get the same degree of response. And then we did one more test afterwards. And what we found was in these athletes who they would take 3 hours to lose, say, 5% of their weight, they would be obviously extremely dehydrated. We then let them rehydrate. And then 3 hours later, they do repeat effort performance so we could assess their physical capacity. And we found kind of two main things in that area, which was one, they made the weight infinitely easier. It was much faster. So in what it would take someone 3 hours to lose and 3 hours of hell, like they were really bad at the end of it, versus once they'd finished the actual heat acclimation protocol, the average, a lot of people were losing it. I think the average time, 122 minutes, if I'm remembering my own data. Obviously, it's hard to pull really specific numbers up, but luckily I've got it. Oh, 122 minutes. There you go.
Yeah, I was going to say, I just looked at it. I was like, good on you.
Yeah. So on average, it took them 122 minutes to lose what it usually took 180 minutes to lose. So, and I had, and there was a bit of variation in that. We had someone who lost it in an hour. And it was massively faster and it was massively easier. And that was one thing as well. We looked at their markers of psychological strain, and we found that their perception of fatigue was considerably lower immediately after the weight cut. And this is for context, right? Their perception of fatigue immediately following the weight cut when they were acclimated was lower than after three hours of recovery in the baseline sessions. So we got them to wake up. We then gave them 3 hours to eat and drink a lot. And then we tested how fatigued they felt psychologically. And that was still worse than immediately getting out the sauna once they were acclimated. So these athletes felt way better. They made that weight easier. And then, which was the moneymaker for me, they performed better. Their repeat effort performance was considerably better following the heat acclimation. So they were able to lose the weight quicker. They were able to lose the weight easier, and they were able to perform better, which for me, obviously was a very interesting finding. And there's a lot of reasons why this might be, and perhaps we could talk about that later because I've been rambling about the study for a while, but we don't know exactly why this helps people perform, but based on the research in heat acclimation, we have some pretty good estimates.
Hmm. Yeah, Oliver, I think it's, as I said earlier, it's something that since we last had our first discussion about it, something that I've put into place with my athletes, and it's something that I find hugely valuable. Now, obviously, I'm not recording and this is all anecdotal. We'll put it out there, but it's something... I'll tell the story of an experience I had with one of my very high level athletes. And again, the athletes I tend to work with are quite high level, and we could be talking a little bit off the bell curve here, but we had an experience where we went through not a horrible weight cut, but it definitely was not ideal. It was very left of ideal. And then we had that conversation and I took them through this protocol, not as strong, not as long as the 1.5 hours times 12, but we did it over 8 weeks and we were able to get two sessions in, and we were in a bit of a hotter environment than what was described in the study. So I adjusted the time in the sauna to be relative to that increase in temperature. But we did do it over 8 weeks. And exactly what you found in this research is exactly what I found when it came time to do this. And when we talk about translating research into practice, this research is something that helped me on the biggest stage for this athlete who is performing their next biggest fight, for quite literally the highest level that you could possibly do in this sport. And this is something, and you touched on there, the psychological impact. And yes, it might have this. We may not know what's going on with the performance, but the psychological impact of doing that practice was huge. And I even saw that in his, and I've done many, many, many of these rapid weight loss sessions with him and weight cuts with him. His persona during this weight cut was completely different. The way that he handled the weight cut was completely different. The time where we normally go silent and there's no talking, that didn't exist. The benefits of doing this from the population I've seen, regardless if there is a performance benefit, I think it warrants just from the psychological benefit you can get from doing that, which anyone that works with athletes knows that a performance is hugely impacted by their psychological state.
Yeah. And that, you know, There's two things I would say for that. One is I'm really happy to hear that it's helping people, and it's because that's the whole reason I got into research, was because I was passionate about combat sports. I didn't get into research because I wanted to do research. Honestly, I got to the end of my bachelor's degree and didn't know what else to do. And I was competing, you know, I was fighting a bit at the time, and I just wanted to learn stuff, and I just wanted combat sports to help with combat sports. And that's really, it's definitely really nice to hear that. The other thing I would point out is how you said you modified the program, is that the study which we published was purely a proof of concept. And I would not say the exact protocol we used is the only protocol that would work. In fact, I would be very happy to bet my life that it's not, it's definitely not the only one that works. We designed it, for example, an hour and a half is probably a bit much, but when you're doing a proof of concept study, we had to overgo a little bit, because if we underdid it and then found no results, there would it would be very hard to justify doing another study and going, oh, we'll just do it a bit bigger this time. So we really wanted to make sure that if we were going to do it, there would be no doubt that they would be heat acclimated. So there's a lot of ways you could tweak it. And with heat acclimation, really, the main thing is that the athlete has their core temperature raised above 38.5 for around half hour. That's usually what we're seeing in terms of heat acclimation. Now, for us, we had a lot of thermal data and stuff, and they were coming in from cold. So a lot of those guys would come in the morning. They'd be quite chilly. They'd hop in the sauna. It'd really take them half hour just for their core temperature to get to that minimum level. And then there'd be another half hour. And then we obviously, because we worried about some people might take longer, we just added an extra half hour on for safety. But there's so many ways I could imagine doing this. And one of the ways I could imagine, which I really want, look, if someone's listening to this and they're a scientist and you want to steal this idea, actually do, because I don't know when I'm going to get the time to do this. And I just want to see the work done. If you want me to be involved, obviously get in touch and I'll be happy to help. But I really want to try, when athletes do a training session, they already get their heat up, and then afterwards, they just immediately hop in a sauna for like half hour. Because the thing is, when we were doing the passive sessions, it just took time. It just required a good half hour to 45 minutes to get the temp up to the right place. But if someone's just done a pretty hard training session, their core temperature is probably already going to be at that point. And then you just need to keep it there consistently. So you could probably get a really big bang for your buck. And the other thing which we found in this study that I feel like I have to point out every time is that we had two groups. One group that drank water and one group that didn't drink water. And we saw no difference between the two groups. So during these acclimation sessions, people can drink as much water as they want. You know, they can. So that's one of the ways I imagine this protocol being used. Ideally might be after training, they finish their training, they hop into a sauna with their water, and they just chill out for half hour, and then they go. And you do that a couple of times a week, and bada bing, bada boom, you're heat acclimated.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like that point that you made. And I think in terms of the research, that's right. Like, your guys' job as the research, especially this early on, is that proof of concept. And I feel like my job, if I want to be a practitioner working with these elite level guys, is figuring out, you know, what's the minimum effort that we can do for the most maximal return. And things like this is definitely what's going to contribute to that. And I just feel like heat acclimation is just one of those areas where you can get so much return for very little risk as well. And as a practitioner in combat sports, when you're quite literally getting punched, kicked and choked out for a living, when you can find something that's going to give you a possible performance benefit for this little effort, to me, that's an absolute golden nugget.
Yeah, it's really cool that we have, because really there's not much risk associated with this kind of area, obviously, especially if people are replenishing fluids as they're going through. And the amount of heat acclimation doesn't have to be insane. Like, you know, if someone's jumping in a sauna for half hour after a training session three times a week, and they're just having some water in there. The potential drawbacks are so minor. That's one of the reasons I really like this study now that it's done. And I'm really happy that, because we were actually, when we were talking about it, we were debating between kind of two ideas. And I was like, I'll do either. It's fine. And eventually we indifferently settled on the heat acclimation one, which now I'm so glad that we did. But it's nice to be able to have something that people can do that is simple, and something that people can do that is relatively risk-free, and something people can do that practitioners like yourself can actually tweak and get the most out of it. Because sometimes I see some studies that propose, oh, this thing can improve performance, but the actual like protocol is so complicated, and there's so much that people have to do. And you know, sometimes it might be, oh, so you take all these supplements at these times, and there's a lot to it. Whereas our one is just get hot for a couple of times a week, and you'll be fine.
Do you think, Oliver, you're talking, obviously it's just post-training and you're getting that initial core temperature to come up. I think we spoke about this on our last episode, is you really see that a lot, and you would have seen it with your kickboxing background and like old school boxing gyms where guys are running or training in their sauna suit. Do you think there could possibly be some merit in that, say after a training session, throwing on the sauna suit and staying warm?
So yes and no. The best kind of yes. Basically, in terms of heat acclimation, it's pretty much time with core temperature above a certain level. You can induce that in any way you feel like, and you're going to develop heat acclimation. Now, it is plausible that someone could put on a sweatsuit afterwards and try and say, do a bit of exercise there. The issue is, and this has always been my big thought about this heat acclimation study, is that heat is a stimulus, and heat has a training effect. And a heat session, though it is low risk, it's not a zero-sum game. Because, and we've tested this, we have pilot data with this, which is a really interesting study that unfortunately I don't think actually got finished. The things we lose in science, but where one of the, basically what he was doing was trying, so they were getting people to train in heat to see if they can induce these heat acclimations. But what they did find was that, and we have seen this across a multitude of research, that the exercising in heat elicits a bigger training strain than exercising in thermoneutral conditions. And the concern is that that would add up over time and result in overtraining, which is one of the reasons why when we did this session, we made it passive, because we wanted to get as little strain on the body and to just get that heat acclimation. And one of my concerns would be, if you put a sweatsuit on after training and then just sat there, I don't imagine it would keep your core temperature high enough for long enough, because you actually do sink out quite a bit of heat with those. But again, I don't have data in this area, so it'd be nice to see. But my guess would be that you wouldn't actually get the right thermal response. But if you exercised with the sweatsuit on, yeah, I reckon you would. But that's a really intense exercise on the body. You can turn what is a pretty easy workout into a very hard feeling workout when you add a sauna suit to it. And my concern in that point would be that people are going to start getting very fatigued from adding that on, and then it's going to reduce the effect of the efficacy of their training camp. Because this is one thing we do know about combat sports athletes, is that they're some of the most overtrained athletes on planet Earth, in particular MMA. Because, you know, if you're going to do MMA, you need to hit your jiu-jitsu, you need to hit your wrestling, you need to hit your striking, or you've also got to do some sparring. Bro, you also need to be pretty strong. Let's hit the weight room. Got to be really fit. Let's do a bit of running. Let's do some high-intensity interval training. Okay, and now it's Wednesday. They have this massive training load already. And my only concern, I had two concerns when we did this study. One was that we would contribute to increased overtraining, which is the entire reason why the initial version of this study was active heat acclimation. And I flat out refused to do it because of this very reason. I was like, even if I prove something, it won't be worth it to anyone because it's just going to make them more overtrained and they're going to have to sacrifice some kind of training because you can't get as good a training session when you're overheated than you can if you're at thermoneutral conditions. You know, if you imagine, if you go for a run in the middle of the day in summer versus, you know, in the morning in spring, you're going to get a better run when the temperature's ideal. So that's been one of the things we need to think about in that case, that you could induce heat acclimation. As if you spend half hour with your core temperature over 38 and a half, you'll get heat acclimation. The question is, we need to think about what are the right ways to do this and fit it in with their camps. And that's not something that we accounted for in this study. It was a proof of concept that we could get people heat acclimated. Now, I think this is a good opportunity to look at the very big body of heat acclimation research and try and see how can we fit this in with these athletes' camps. But unfortunately, in that case, there's actually not that much research looking at passive heat acclimation. Most of it seems to look in the area of active, which is something which we need to do more research on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we just hit time there, all of us. So that's what a statement to finish it on. I think just summing that up quickly, heat acclimation, extremely good in the research from what we have from Oliver's study, very promising. From what I've seen anecdotally with the few athletes that I've done it on a very high level, very, very promising. I've definitely included it in my protocols. And again, it's that passive one, sitting in the sauna. You can even do it in a bathtub if you control it again. But yeah, again, the risks go up when you're doing it active. So stick to the passive and then happy days. Enjoy getting heat acclimated. Ola.
I would say just before you wrap up, I would be remiss if I didn't point out, obviously, there are inherent risks with heat exposure. And if someone is going to try and heat acclimate themselves, make sure you're keeping yourself well hydrated when you're going in there and try to make sure that there's someone around you so that you're not doing it by yourself unless you're really confident that you're going to be fine. And if you start to feel bad, just pull yourself out. Don't try and overly push through it.
Yeah, that was a good point. I think you said in our first podcast is don't view this as mini weight cuts. This is not mini weight cutting sessions. This is just training your body to be better at sweating. I think that's a good way to look at it because you wouldn't go through a whole training session with not drinking any fluid. So don't view it as a mini weight cutting, view it as training, stay hydrated and get the most out of it. So Oliver, last question. People want to get onto you. They want to talk to you about this more. They want to pick your brains about hydration, heat acclimation, anything to do with combat sports science. What's the best way for people to get onto you?
So I would say the first one is to follow me on Twitter and just tweet at me, which is at Oliver Barley. It's Barley, B-A-R-L-E-Y, not B-A-L-I-E, that's the country. And also, if you want to email me, it's o.barley@ecu.edu.au. And I'm happy to talk to people about weight cutting. This is all about science in general. This is the whole reason I got into this. So if anyone wants to chat, you know, tweet at me or email me and we can get on it.
Yeah, absolutely. We can get on the science. All right, Oliver, thanks for coming back on, mate. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'll aim to be the first person to come back on for a third time.
Yeah, I think we'll do the three-peat. I've got you and Dr. Carl Evans are in contention for it, for the three-peat, but we'll see. Be good either way. All right, mate, we'll chat soon, okay? Right.
Thanks. See you later.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Dr. Barley is continuing to build the body of combat sports research and evolve the sport for the better. His work in assessing hydration is pivotal for us to better understand how to adequately rehydrate our athletes, and his work in heat acclimation is proving to be one of the most impactful pieces of work to come out of his lab. Stay up to date with all of his work by following him on Twitter. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.